All right, thanks all for coming. I know this is the last session, and I know that there is some compelling competition. So, a boring subject, hopefully we'll make it relatively exciting and interesting. It's really about how we use the client principle, all the things we had to discover and try and work out and use in order to make it work for us. It's in no way complicated. It's in no way super complicated, as I say. It's just what we use, how we make it simple. It's a simple client principle for us. So hopefully we can send some of that stuff down to you guys. Okay, a little brief history, help out myself. Version 3, I'm not a DBA guy, okay? So all the, unfortunately the mic's not here, so I'm about to take the mickey out of it. I'm not a DBA guy, so I know enough to keep things running. You know, my database is 11.3, and I was thinking about this the other night. I think that I last did a dump and load on V8. It's that long ago, I can't remember. It runs. And I've got the best way of dealing with database upgrades and performance problems. I just buy bigger Ryan. Works for me. So keep Tom out of the job. So I may get some stuff wrong. I'm running rotten tomatoes around here, just need to know who's going to be throwing this stuff. I do know enough about security to make me paranoid, which is a good thing in some ways. And you should be too. This is not a nice thing to be. The amount of hacking tools out there now for password cracking and algorithms, the mind boggles about these super intelligent, spotty teenagers sitting in their bedroom calculating billions of hash records per second and everything like that. We've got to be aware of it, we've got to be careful. So, we're going to have a little bit of security, about open edge security, how we used to use set user ID and stuff like that before client principle came along. Have a brief look at the client principle, how we should set it up, how we should run with it. Getting a little bit deeper, I'm being stupid by doing a live demo of how you set up a domain and authentication and everything all the way from scratch. And of course it's going to work. We've got how we use it in the wild, how we actually deploy and implement this. There are some further things that we could do with session storage and stuff like that. If we have the time, I can describe how we handle that. This is also known as real code. This is how we use it in production rather than in a manual or in some configuration template that you've got to look at. And the tips and tricks that come from that. And of course, there's going to be half an hour of questions because you guys have so much things to ask. No? Okay. So the disclaimer, this talk includes information about real world products and applications. What I'm about to say reflects our current thinking, but the information contained is probably heretical and wrong, and it will change. Because as you go through things, you learn different stuff. So if you're reading this in 4 years' time, and I say something completely different, do what I'm doing then, not now. No, now, not then. Because it will change. Things get better, hopefully.
That's the assumption.
Ah, oh, okay.
So yes. Oops. So any future talks on the subject may be materially different from this one. So, are there any users here? Good. Had this in the same speech yesterday. Users are challenging. I think that's the way I put it. When it comes to security and passwords, how many times you lift up a keyboard, see their password underneath, etc., etc. So, who's on version 11? Okay. 11.1 and above?
I don't use that old stuff.
The reason why I'm asking is that there's a significant difference between 11.0 and 11.1, and the one I want to talk about is an 11.1 plus feature, so it's important this. So we had some new features for client principle introduced in 11, like the initialized method. This is terrible, my eyes are so bad I can't read this. The PAM status, which is built in class to return some certain values and stuff. Get DB clients, DB list. This is the important one, callbacks. This makes security easy, or client principle easy, in 11.1 and above. So if you've been struggling with client principle, with domain codes and access codes and trying to seal things and do all that sort of stuff, which I was trying to do in 11.3 until I found the callbacks, which makes life much easier. So we will be concentrating on the 11 features instead of V10, it's not secure. There are no callbacks, and it doesn't have the same number of helper methods and things like that. So it is V11 stuff. So why do we need user authentication? These are my users. So my users think I'm on some sort of magical figure because I can guess what their passwords are.
An astral dog.
So if I can guess their passwords, the passwords are very, very simple and very easy. And part of the strategies you've got to come up with is trying to make sure that your passwords are relatively secure. Because it doesn't matter what you do with client principle. It doesn't matter what levels of security you bury this thing under, or how complex you make it, or to store it, or whatever it is. If their password is ABC123, your client principle is compromised. You have to have the right passwords. You guys all have SOCs over here, don't you? Sarbanes-Oxley. We have the FSA, same sort of thing. Evil people trying to hurt you. But you've got to be aware of these. I tried reading that, I gave up. I just assume I have to have decent security. This is the lesson I learned from that one. Customer requirements. If you're doing work on behalf of customers or you're selling your product to customers, they may have all sorts of security requirements. You have your application requirements. You might have parts of your application have to have a certain authorization level. So you can store all that in your requirements. Progress marketing buzzword, NTR applications, if you're using app servers and web servers and all that sort of stuff. How many people fire up an app server and just run something on there? There's no security. So the only security is what you start the app server up with.
Yeah.
And by bypassing client principles across the wire, if you want to, you can set security to be the same client. Same user as it is on the client. Auditing. Everyone must use auditing, surely. When you use a client principle, the user ID is set in the auditing records, which is very useful. So who did what, where, and when. For those of you who don't use it, there's often some real use for that, which you might not think of. One of the things in our application is something that stores some data. And we had an incident where someone changed a client out of a client group, and all hell broke loose because we didn't report some of the information we should have reported. And I was told that I have to implement full audit trails on all my applications. And I've given months to do this and resources to do this, and I did it the next day. So just turned on auditing. It works, it's great. The other thing you've got to remember, authorization is not authentication, and vice versa. Just because the system knows who you are, it doesn't mean it knows what you're allowed to do. Client principle doesn't help you with this, but you can store some information in it for, say, roles and stuff like that. So your application still has to take the authentication information and decide what level of responsibility or authorization that user has. So it's not a magic silver bullet, but it helps knowing who it is to start off with, which is always a good start. And these are called, as we said, roles, responsibilities, whatever you want to do. And as I said, you should always have been tracking changes to critical data, even if you're not being told to. The time will come where your CEO or boss or says, I need to know who changed that. And if you don't have it, it's your fault, even if you haven't been told to do it. So even just, if you know what your critical bits of information are, start logging them, start logging the changes, and use the auditing systems. I like the auditing system. I know you don't, I do.
I do like it. I'm just weary of auditing everything.
Oh, no, you don't audit everything.
Exactly.
You're critical of it.
Audit everybody else.
However, this is beyond the scope of this presentation. Full documentation is in that big URL there for 11.3. So, set user ID. We've always used set user ID, yeah? From V3 onwards?
At least four.
At least.
Yeah, so that's what we do. Set user ID, name, password. All very simple, all very easy. I think it's been in there since V3, so I'm not going to do the argument with you. However, I'm not old enough to remember that. Or she'll say, I am old enough, my memory is failing. It's a simple premise, as we say, user, password, and database. It tries to match your user account in the underscore user record, which has its challenges, that table, I would say. And it returns a true or false. To say, yes, that password made it, that'll do. Maintenance of the user table is painful. I hope everyone agrees with that.
Oh, yeah.
Only the logged in user can change the password.
Just delete it, recreate it.
Yeah, that's not the right way of doing it. Sort of that begs the question.
I wish somebody had fixed that.
How can the logged in user change their password if they don't know what their password is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the only solution is to delete the record.
Yeah.
Which just means you've got to cycle through, you've got to try and copy all the data and that's in there, make sure you've got the right name. It's stupid.
Just that.
Yeah. Not very pleasant. You have to set user ID for each connected database as well. I believe there's some systems out there that connect to more than one database. And it doesn't generate any audit events, even for logging the logout. So if you've just got audits and you need just to know who's logged in and logged out, sure you can look at the database logs, because that has user IDs now changed, etc. But it's not easily interrogatable from the client. Some of the most serious problems though is it doesn't meet any security standards by a long way. There are three that I know of programs out there that will crack a user ID password very, very simply, very, very quickly. And when I talk quickly, I mean a matter of minutes, not a long time, minutes. Your user table is open. You can run through your user table and display the encoded password. So you have access to the password table, you have access to these cracking programs, boom, application compromised. Stop searching the internet for these cracking programs, guys. It's not relatively complicated, it's not easy or it's relatively complicated to access the external authentication systems. So the problem is, yes, we used a Active Directory authentication, But in order to set user ID, we had to then set it, the set using set user ID with a name and a known password, which it made sure the users were happy because they had single sign-on, so they thought. But it meant that actually the application security was very, very dangerous because you just knew what the password was. And you can't log out and validate the authentication session. The client principal, you can actually log out and make sure that this client principal can't be used within the session. Much improved since version 10. Part of my problem is I'm probably trying to use it in 10 or 10.1 or 10.2. And it was so complicated to try and work out what they were doing. And the, one of the things that I really didn't like is you had to know what the domain access code was in order to seal the client principal, which sort of made me think, ooh. So I was trying all sorts of things because my background, I would say, is I'm a kind of hacker. I grew up on the old Z80 machines and cracked games and gave myself infinite lives and all that sort of stuff. So one of the first things I ever do is do a strings on any executable to find out what's in there and use those as the table for cracking stuff. And if you've got a string in the R code, it's pretty obvious that one of those strings is probably the domain code, if you know what the security program is. So it's all fairly easy to grab. So you start using really strange stuff, like one of my original keys was defra as char. So anyone trying to crack it would see it. We'll see. The 11.3 is much, much better. The client principal represents a login session for a user. And you can share this session between app servers and agents. So you can go to the app server, log in, get a client principal, send it back to the client, and that client can then use that as a session and pass it backwards and forwards. Which is really useful for stateless app servers because you can re-establish your client authentication and credentials. It sets the user ID for the ABI application and for the database connection. And it audits login and logout. Really useful, which you can then interrogate from the 4GL field if you wanted to. 11.3 allows you to have your own authentication schemes, but there are a couple of built-in ones. The external ones like LDAP and stuff are much improved since version 10. The interesting thing is the client principal can be exported as a raw bit of data, which means what you can do is store that raw bit of data in the database table and create a session ID or a GUI ID or something and only pass a session ID backwards and forwards rather than the whole client principal. So you've got a choice there whether you want to pass this big chunk of thing across or just a certain key or a randomized key or something like that. The randomized key obviously makes it a lot harder to try and steal the credentials. And one of the dangers with the client principal is if there's a man-in-the-middle type attack, you can grab that client principal. And if that's been validated and sealed, it's a valid client principal. So you could just take that and say, yes, this is me. So I would recommend that you probably store this client principal, encrypt it, as we were talking, in the database table and pass a session ID backwards and forwards. Once it's sealed, the data in the client principal can't be changed. So it's a fixed, definite piece of information. You can add custom properties to the client principal. So you can add all sorts of stuff that you want and then bundle it all in as one unit. So we need to do several things. You need to set up authentication systems, you need to set up domains, you need to add or change a couple of database options. But that's actually very, very simple to do now. It's very, very easy. So this is the authentication system for the sports database. These are the built-in ones. We've got SSO, and we've got only user table that was local. We use our own, so we don't use any of these. The OE user table, I believe, is the same as set user ID effectively reads the underscore user table?
No. Or the OE user table?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the underscore.
So if you're going to use that, that's the same as underscore user. Let's see the description of that. The domain type tells you what you're calling it. Now, in the two different streams, they're called two different things, which is slightly confusing until you understand that. So the domain might call it authentication system. The name's a domain type, which is it's authentication type for me. This is the cool part of 11.3, callback. You can enable a callback program to do your authentication. So now you can have your own user table. You can use Active Directory if you wanted to, or anything like that. And your program does the authentication, and if it reports, returns it as a success, the client principle is sealed with that validation. So you can use whatever mechanisms you want, whatever security, whatever algorithms, whatever you want to verify a user, which you couldn't do before 11.3. So in the domains, we have various different domains. Again, there's some standard built-in ones. The blank domain is the default user one. When you log in as Joe, if you supply the user as Joe to the client principal, it will use a blank domain. If you went Joe at, let's create one here called foo, then it uses the foo domain and the authentication, or the system type they call it here. So on the other one is domain type, here it's system type. Which is the confusing part. So let me just reiterate that. That system type is your authentication system. So I was now trying to find where the system type was. I was looking through all the menus and couldn't find it. So the domain options, there's our authentication system. What authentication are we using for this domain? The access code here is what was, if you're not using callbacks, you enter some code. There's two complications to this. One, it's a password field, so you can't see what you're typing.
Doesn't ask to be verified.
Doesn't ask to be verified.
Sorry.
So you can think you've typed it in right and haven't. And the other thing is you can't paste into it either. So the first thing I did is, because I'm paranoid, I generated this huge 72-character password with my password generator and tried to paste it in. It's no good to type it. So the problem with that, of course, is that the longer it is, the more chance you have of getting it wrong, so you tend to choose shorter and shorter and shorter domain keys. The other problem is, as I said, that domain key, if it's a string of random characters, is actually quite obvious when you're doing the strings on the R code, because it sticks out like a sore thumb. So it's very easy to guess the domain access code. So callbacks solve all those problems. If you're using callback, you don't need an access code. Audit context is where, if you're doing some audit captures and stuff, there's a column for audit context, so you can say each domain can have a separate audit context for reporting purposes and stuff like that. Runtime options and system options are data that's passed into a callback. They don't actually mean anything, it's just a way of you passing some custom data loop. So they're the ones we've been talking about in detail. And I put these notes in to remind myself. This is the authentication system that we defined earlier. This is the access code, which is case sensitive as well. Its caps lock does screw you up on that one. And we say here that the domain with the same name and access code must exist in the DB for a client principal to be sealed. So when you're sealing a client principal and using it to authenticate against the database, the domain that you've sealed it with must be in the target database. So in the database options, there's a few other things here. Use application domain registry. It's confusing. Maybe we can do this.
Hold on.
Just probably spotted something.
Bring up your little book on the right hand side. So, okay, so this access code thing is confusing me as well. It's always confusing me. Access code could, a domain with the same name and access code must exist in the DB for still client permission to be validated.
Yes, because let's say I connect to database A, which has the name FUBAR. Yeah? And I validate my client principal and I seal it. So now my client principal has that domain, Jeff at FUBAR. Let's say I now connect to another database called X, and I want to use that client principal to verify my authentication against X.
Okay.
X must also have FUBAR defined in it as a domain.
But you were saying a second ago that if you use the callback option, you need to specify an access code. So
no, the access code is a code that you need to seal the client principal.
Okay.
But when you're saying that to the ABM, here's my sealed client principal, authenticate this database, please. So it's not redoing the authentication. You're telling the ABM this is valid, use it. But the data, it will complain if the domain isn't in there. Or at least that's what I trouble I have with it. So. Yes. The application registry as opposed to the database domain registry. Again, what you're saying is trust the program, guys. Yeah, this program knows everything. I'm going to add a domain in my program programmatically, and you can trust this, which again is kind of dodgy. Use callbacks, you don't really need that at all. One of the little things that snuck into, was it 11? Without much fanfare, which perhaps should be. We're all used to compile time checking with the can read and can write. This does it at runtime. So if you set can read, can write on your database tables, you can change them now, and the R code will double check. Yeah, exactly. I was quite surprised when I found that one, because I think that's quite a big thing.
Yeah.
More docs on that would be helpful. But that's really, really a good security thing to put in.
It is.
Everyone's going, yeah, cool. Okay, there's some gotchas. I battled for a long time, so I was trying to write my own authentication program using access codes and domains and all sorts of stuff. And I thought I'd try to get the primary pass phase of unsealed client principal and try and then validate it against my user table. And I kept getting compile errors because it wouldn't access it. I keep going back to the documentation, it's definitely there, but it won't compile, and it was a bit confusing. You can only access primary pass phase from within your authentication callback program. So when you try and validate the client principal, it will run the callback to say authenticate. In that callback, you've got the user, you've got the password, and that's how you can use that to authenticate against your own systems. We have talked about domain access codes being very, very hard to keep secret. There's no point trying to obfuscate it because someone's going to find it. If they have access to R code, somewhere in your R code is your key. Even if you've encrypted it and then try and decrypt it, because your key to the encryption's in your R code somewhere. Don't try and fool these guys. My guys, my typing guy. Because we'll find it. And good example of that, maybe I shouldn't say this too much, but the encrypted source code, for example. It's easy to decrypt, very easy. So again, don't rely on that if you want to keep your source code to yourself, because it isn't. You might as well just distribute the source code and make it easy for everyone. There's no point in encrypted source code, because it's so easy to break. This is a major gotcha. If you don't know about this, it's going to bite you in the bum sometime. Security policy gets client, returns a client principal handle. Brilliant. You have to delete that handle. Otherwise, it leaks. So if you've got a loop running that gets client principal and there's on a security thing like I did, because I thought there's no point storing a variable and having to handle the variable, I should just use the client thing. Well, that's just much by memory. And I knew it was that one because I'd only just put that in and I didn't have a memory link for it. To be fair, it says it in the documentation. Which is another radical departure from progress, actually saying, yeah, there's a memory leak here. We're not going to fix it, but we documented it, so there we go, fixed. I don't know if it can be fixed or not, but that's the way it is. It returns a handle, you have to delete that handle, otherwise it will leak.
So what, delete object?
Delete the handle variable. Delete object handle.
That sets the handle that returns from get client.
Yeah.
Okay.
So don't say, you need to store that in a variable and then delete the handle. Because if you just refer to it in the function, you have this handle that you have no reference to.
Okay. Alright, yeah, so it's the value that
gets
client.
Uh-oh.
What did you expect it to do?
I was surprised. I thought the handle would be a constant static thing on the client security principle. I didn't think it'd return a different handle every time.
Okay, I have my answer.
So the right answer?
There's no wrong answer.
If you store your client principal records, you must secure that as much as you can. Otherwise, you are going to have some problems. A long-lived client principal is a security risk. Really what you should do is make it last as little as possible. When you create a client principal object, there's something called login expiry date or login expiry time or something like that. I can't quite remember what it is. But you need to set that to be a reasonable period of time. Because if someone somehow manages to get hold of that sealed principal, if it's a week's time, doesn't matter, because it's expired. So recreate them often. Change the login time to be relatively short. Look at what you're trying to achieve in a session, for example. You know, with ours, we set a maximum of 8 hours, because that's the login time. Our agents work for 8 hours a day. So we make it 9 hours, actually. So we say, login, 9 hours later, it's expired, which helps with some security. So at some stage, someone probably will get hold of this stuff. You might get that error sometimes. And you have no idea what it means. Because it's like, okay, what is this? So the context operation could not find, so when you do a search for this error number, that's the message you get. So, okay, yeah, doesn't exactly explain much more than the message did. It's like, what it means is, I can't find your program. So, this callback program that you've put to callback isn't available. It can't find it, so it comes up with this esoteric error. So if you see that, your authentication program is missing, or it's got the wrong parameters. I also forgot. Try avoiding as much as possible using set user ID after you have a valid client principal. Set user ID overrides the client principal and doesn't change it if you try and reset it.
So it invalidates it?
No, it doesn't invalidate, it just sets it to whatever you set user ID to. So if I've got client principal, I log in as Julian, sealed, and I set. So I say, the session used this client principal as Julian, database uses client principal, so my database login is Julian. If I then say set user ID foobar, My database is foo. My session's still doodling. But you can't, if you then say set database client again, it's now locked. So even if you change, let me come back to this. What I was doing is, on the web speed stuff, there was a client, you logged in as a client, or you had a client session. So I logged the person in as a client. But one of the things I needed to do was to update another session, but as a system user. So I stored the current user ID, I set user ID to the system user, and I then reset using my client principle, Julian. Apart from it didn't. Because it says in the documentation, if you use set user ID, it locks the database down and doesn't change it again until you set user ID with a set DB client with a question mark, unknown value. So you've got to do an extra step and then you can unlock it. So be careful. You don't need to use set user ID once you've got client principle. So be careful of strange set user IDs in your code somewhere. They will bite you.
So if you have to use it, you have to, when you reset it back, what do you set to unknown value?
The set DB client.
Oh, okay.
So you say set DB client unknown, and then you can say set DB client, the client principle handle. So it overrides and locks out. So this is now going to be an interesting session about passwords. Because I had some views and I was getting ready to go all of this, and during a slide review, I had my ass kicked. Because that's wrong, that's not right. So there's some various things here. Do not try. It depends. The problem with changing your passwords on a very regular basis is people forget what they wrote or what they changed it to. So either your help desk is inundated with calls every second Tuesday, I can't remember my password, and you have to have IT rings bells. But unfortunately, sometimes this is out of your control because you've got some power-hungry domain mad. Any domain admins out here? Idiot. Try. Who insists on this massive complexity and it has to change every 5 hours. It's like, all they can do is write it down. It's not secure. One of the best things you can do is add a time delay between sign-in attempts to stop a brute force attack. Because the stats to say, oh, we can compute 36 billion attempts per second. Not if there's a second delay between each attempt, you can't. It's quite simple. Very, very simple process. And you can actually start changing that, because the first two or three times, you might want maybe half a second or a third of a second, because you might go, Fred. Yes. Oh, no, it's John. But that's a second already. But if there's more than 3 or 4 or 5 attempts, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, lock out 30 seconds.
But don't lock the user out after 3, because then they're going to call the help desk.
Yes.
Well, the first one, the first time you get it wrong, you think you spelled it wrong.
Yeah.
The second time you get it wrong, you think, oh, maybe I had caps lock on it. The third time you get it wrong, you're puzzled, think, oh, well, maybe it's the one before that. So you need at least. I don't know, 8 or 10.
Yeah. I mean, because I'm aware, so what password do I use for this place? Let me try that. No, that didn't work. Well, let me try this one.
And the second time you get it wrong, you're done.
It's like,
okay. I'm sorry.
The OWASP standards suggest locking you up for like 15 minutes.
And that would be okay.
Tries.
Yeah.
Now, there was a theory that if you allowed sentences or words as passwords rather than complicated stuff, it would make things much more secure. So, My Little Pony.
Oh, that's a great one.
Now we know.
There's a funny reference to this, actually. One of my OO speeches I gave. I was explaining how methods work, and I had a method called do stuff with something. And I was just trying to think what something would be, and just my little daughter comes in, and she goes, wow, I've got a little bunny. So I'll pass that as a parameter. Yeah, I didn't see the reference to this. So here I am, a room full of people. I bring up this, and the first thing Peter judges is burst out laughing. Right there, in massive code, do stuff with My Little Pony. Yes, as I pointed out, it's probably illegal in most countries. I've never been allowed to forget it, so I put in a self-deprecating reference in here to please the people I know. Bacon, lettuce and tomato? My favourite breakfast? It's not a bad password, well, so you think. Another day, another password. So there's various things. All of these can be easily cracked. Easily cracked.
Because they're sentence fragments, they're not full sentences.
Well, originally, they were very, very secure. Because people just used dictionary attacks. Take this word, take this word, take this word. Maybe a combination of words. And then they start. So once you get past two words, it becomes, you know, the whole thing starts going like this. What the clever buggers are starting doing now is they're starting using Wikipedia and YouTube and IRC, and they're grabbing sentences and they're grabbing all this stuff and hashing those to see if you can match something. So it's less secure than complicated passwords now. So we have this here. Everyone remember the horse, correct? So they'll try and point out you have all this complication stuff here, and you had tend to be easy to get for computers and easy to remember for users. So they write it down and they do this and they do that. So they thought that this would be better, and you tried to do this with calculations and you remembered it. Now, I thought that was true until I had my backside kicked. And I was pointed to a few articles which made me have to swallow my pride and admit I was wrong, and yeah, thanks, Tom. So I'm putting a positive spin on this now by saying, yes, I can learn.
That's good. It's been trainable.
So apparently this lasts for about 2 weeks before I started all this stuff. And again, there's some documentation, so you've got to be careful with what you find on the net now, because all this stuff actually seems to prove that these multi-word passwords are actually very secure. But not if you use the new attack vectors that are coming in. And that's the problem. They were secure with the old attack vectors. But some bright spark would come up with something else, and you screw it, basically. A couple of these slides will be available offline, so if you wanted to have a look at these links, they explain why this stuff is very, very nasty. Out of the 4,400 unique words or phrases they mined from Twitter, 2,000 of them were actual passwords. Half of the words they got from the military singles website or hashtags, half of them were passwords used by people using that site.
Like you get a date pretty easy.
I've at least seen the phrase of a hoo-ha! But there were the passwords. And the phrases used, this blew my mind. It was like, it cost this guy $800 to build this machine. $800. And it can do 30 billion guesses per second. That's a lot of words. It's.
I think that many words.
Yeah. And there's his rig. So there's a graphic card just sitting there powering away. Why graphics cards?
Usually more powerful than that.
They do superb number crunching for texture analysis. So they are specialized number crunchers. Fire four of those puppies up in parallel and you've got some serious kit. You'd probably find NSA has about 30 of those lined up.
Well, no, they've got that new 2000 processor board that's under 2K, so. Yeah.
So never, ever, 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 ever. I mean, you tell your children never, ever, ever, ever do something. And you're not children, but I'm saying never store your text in plain text, in passwords in plain text, right? It's a wonderful site. Plain text offenders. They tell you which sites do store your passwords in plain text. And so it's quite scary. Starbucks? Anyone? Anyone got a mobile app for Starbucks? Your password's in plain text.
That's okay, it's everywhere.
So yeah, in January, they found that Starbucks had plain text. If a site says, email me my password, get off that site.
Progress stores your password in plain text. Been doing it for years.
Do not use a site. Sorry, Progress. Don't use a site that stores that password. Because they have it in plain text, or they have some way of getting it back, which is encrypted somehow, so that again, you can, if it's encrypted, you can decrypt it. What you should do is have a site that salts something, or is a one-way encryption, so it can't be got back. So never, ever, ever, ever store passwords with reversible encryption. That's a bad thing too. Always hash the password before storing. So in your user table, you normally have your username, and you have your password, or the encrypted form of your password. And you should always, what's called salt, or always hash your password. Give every user a separate salt, which is a different encryption key, effectively, before you hash the password. Because that way, each password is encrypted differently for all the users. So every user should have a different salt. And where possible, try use HTTPS, because that's much simpler. That's not good. And so what if the NSA can see it? They see everything. Don't. And always have a low-level user with no permissions and no roles. Because what you do then is when your app server sessions are finished, you log out that user and you log in this low-level user. So that if something goes wrong or the user ID isn't set or something like that, at least the default is a user that can't do anything. Again, I made the mistake of forgetting to do that. And when I logged in as an admin onto my app server and came back off again, that process was still running as me as an admin, even though I'd finished my session. So I'm going to say, let's do this, let's create a new authentication system and go through the whole options. We'll validate the user code and password, and we'll store and retrieve the principles. Are there any questions first? Oh.
Is there a mechanism to prevent someone from swapping out the callback, like their own version of the callback?
This is the setup.
No.
So it's not storing a hash up for...
It will do very soon.
I've been alerted.
It, we found that and Rose was working on it. So yes, it's there's a problem there. But Rose have not been fixed now. Any other questions?
Does Progress have a built-in library for bcrypt?
For what, sorry?
Bcrypt.
There are, I don't think there's bcrypt, there's several
algorithms. That's the algorithm you were describing, the salting action.
No, you can do encryption with different salts as well. I mean, there's SHA-1, 512.
512,
128. Yeah, there's various SHAs.
What one-way hashes are supported?
There's a lot more.
Yeah, we added 128 and 256. 512.
To SHA.
That's a couple of others, isn't it?
Yeah. That was the state of the art 2 years ago. It moved on.
It shows how much it changed in just 2 years.
So what version was it?
11. What version was it in?
I think that should at least be in the 1.2. Take a look. I don't remember 100%.
Well, it seems we're out of time, unfortunately, so I'll do this afterwards if anyone wants to stay, but in the meantime, your lunch is out there, so thanks for coming.